Hey guys, welcome to Cinephile episode 10. Today's episode, we're going to be talking about something that isn't talked about a lot, and that is documentaries. Something that I think is overlooked a lot within modern cinema, but something that should certainly be appreciated. So we're going to be analyzing Hillary's America by Dinesh D'Souza, and whether or not it is a documentary and what it says about documentary, and we're going to contrast it against all the greatness that is documentary. And like always, we're going to start off with our recommendations, and we're going to be kicking it off with our co-host, Kyle Montgomery.
Hey, y'all. This is Kyle. I chose a documentary today to recommend. I think we all did because of the subject of the episode. Mm-hmm. And I chose a film that I saw recently from who I consider one of the all-time great documentarians, my personal favorite, Errol Morris.
He's fantastic.
He's absolutely fantastic. He, for the last several films, has teamed up with Robert Richardson, who's one of America's modern giants of cinematography. You've seen his work in Kill Bill, Inglourious Bastards, all of Tarantino's modern stuff, JFK, Nixon. He's just incredible. But Errol Morris is really the heart and soul of the film. I don't think either of y'all have seen Standard Operating Procedure yet.
No, I haven't.
A little summary. It examines the incidents of abuse and torture of suspected terrorists at the hands of U.S. forces at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Yeah, it is incredible. And I think what sets this film apart, and what sets all of Errol Morris's films apart for me, is his honest curiosity. Unlike the film we're going to be talking about later in the episode, it really feels like you're on a journey with Errol Morris as he gets to the bottom of something he's curious about. It doesn't sound like he set out to make this film with a political agenda, which is really difficult considering how absolutely politically divisive it is. I mean, it's about the Iraq War.
Right.
Yeah. All you have to do is bring up Iraq War and somebody's got a huge opinion about it, you know? Huge. So yeah, he's just honestly curious. The film is surprisingly beautiful considering how ugly and violent the pictures of Abu Ghraib prison are that spurred this whole international incident.
Well, I mean, his editing, I mean, we don't even have to talk about the cinematography, which obviously is top notch, but just the editing in his films, they tell the story. And such a, when you say it's, you know, his movie is beautiful, I would say a lot of it has to do with that. His like intent and his drive, like how he's opposing different shots and scenes that makes you think and actually feel something for the characters or what is actually happening in people's lives and put it in perspective of your own life or in situations you've been in. I don't know. It's very, very well done. It's a piece of art. His documentaries are artful.
They really are. They're artful, they're poetic, they're informative. But really, at the end of the day, what I respect so much about him is his films, to me, show our shared humanity. Yeah. And I know that sounds like a really big idea. There's a guy named Brian McDonald who wrote a book called The Golden Theme for screenwriters. And basically, the idea is the strongest stories show us that we're all human. And that's what Errol Morris does. And so he's got a companion book called Believing is Seen, which actually has a couple of his own essays that kind of spurred his initial investigation into these photographs, these documentary photographs that, you know, brought this international incident to everyone's attention. And in that, one of his editors pointed at this young American soldier who was smiling over a dead body with her thumbs up and called her evil. And Errol Morris thought to himself, and he called him on, he's like, I don't know, is she really evil? Is she really a bad person? Do you know her? And throughout this film, Standard Operating Procedure, you hear from the soldiers who did these things, which is not the story you hear elsewhere.
Right. It's not, you know, normal documentary that's doing journalism or some sort of investigation is looking from the outside in, where he's able to get this crazy point of view literally from the people themselves.
Like, yeah. And you say crazy point of view, and it's crazy in how unique it is.
Right. That's
But what you find out is it's not so crazy.
No.
These people could be you and me, and they're put in this situation, and people make mistakes. They're not demons any more than the people they suspected of terrorism are demons. They're not evil. A lot of these guys are caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I don't know. I think it's beautiful for how it reminds me not to judge before I know, if you can ever really know the whole story.
It's hard to beat Errol Morris.
It is. It's a tough one to follow up.
Yeah, it's really hard to beat Errol Morris. I mean, I just found out because we watched Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control in school, and I didn't know that was Errol Morris. But I remember thinking back on that movie, being like, that was one of my favorite movies I watched.
I'm very disappointed in the fact I fell asleep throughout that entire movie.
Oh, that is disappointing.
I was
because it's really good.
I sat in the front row so that I wouldn't, and I remember, like, the circus tent. And
right, because there's a lion tamer.
Yeah,
it's basically just a quick synopsis without getting too deep, because we need to go on to our next movie. But Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control is a documentary that covers four different professionals in vastly different fields. We have like a lion tamer, a naked mole rat scientist, some robotics engineer, and then a gardener.
Yeah, who creates these magnificent hedge creatures.
Yeah, like he's like a hedge like sculptor. Out of The Shining.
Oh, like topiary.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so the documentary follows these four people and somehow connects the dots and shows how similar their jobs are to each other as far as like the human condition.
Yeah, that's what it all comes back to with his films, and it's brilliant.
Oh. I'll check that out. That sounds cool.
It's Errol Morris.
I would recommend him to everybody on Earth. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what political side of the spectrum you on.
Oh yeah,
he makes entertaining movies that really just remind us that we're all human
and doesn't have inflamed rhetoric. He's not pushing an agenda. I mean, there obviously he has a point of view he's trying to get across, but it's very fair, and it's not
and you arrive at that conclusion with him, which I think is part of the power of it,
right?
Unlike Hillary's America. Not to jump too far into that, or other political documentaries. You know, you'll go see something like Blackfish, and you know from the outset.
There's a conclusion.
Yeah, there's a conclusion. Begin. Yeah, where you don't get that
Fahrenheit 9/11 or something like that.
Sure.
Yeah. But getting it with Neil, what did you want your recommendation to be for a documentary?
Yeah, okay, so moving on. We can talk about Errol Morris pretty much all episodes.
We're blue in the face, but let's move on a little bit.
Maybe we will someday.
Yeah, we'll have an episode for him soon.
Okay, so my movie is called The Pruitt-Igoe Myth. Mm-hmm. So it is a documentary that follows, or it's basically trying to retell the story of Pruitt-Igoe, which was the projects in St. Louis back in the 50s, 60s. Destroyed, I think, in the early 80s, maybe late 70s.
I'll look it up.
But the story today that we know for Pruitt-Igoe myth is that, or I'm sorry, for Pruitt-Igoe is that it's just a failure in progressive city planning. You know, it proves that we can't do modern progressive architecture because they're doomed to fail. In this movie, kind of reframes the narrative to say, well, it's more complicated than that. And here's interviews of people that live there. And here's the context of St. Louis history that we're not usually talking about. It's really good. The score on it is fantastic.
It's so hard sometimes to really understand or to be given to find the context of all of these political stories, especially from history. We weren't alive then. You know, maybe we'd have better political context for something that happened now.
Right. Because we remember what we remember. You know, it's like we were there. I saw it on TV. I talked to people during then. This is what really happened. And you can be, you know, if someone's feeding you nonsense on an event that you have no
firsthand knowledge,
then it's fact to you.
Yeah.
This person was there. He did the research. He knows what's right.
Especially when generations of politicians have been using it, these things that perhaps they've taken out of context, they use it to forward their argument.
Right. Yeah.
And as we'll find out later, taking something out of context is so powerful.
I mean, it's hard to argue against, too.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting sidetrack. The same architect who made Pruitt-Igoe also was a guy who made the World Trade Centers.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So interesting. His name is Minoru Yamasaki. So
interesting. If you see Pruitt Igoe, it's a behemoth.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. No, when you described it, I didn't realize it, but I mean.
And there was like, I don't know, like 15?
33.
Oh, there's 33.
33 buildings.
And they're big.
Mm-hmm. They were behemoths, without a doubt.
And I don't know, like, who is listening, like, what, you know, how old our viewership is, but there's probably a good chunk of people that don't even know what Pruitt Igoe is.
They, I had no idea.
They've,
no
they've
idea.
Never heard of it. And it's a really important part of St. Louis history. That it's, you know, it for sure goes hand in hand with what happened at Ferguson and the tensions of like race relations in St. Louis.
Yeah.
But we don't really think of it because we weren't there for it. Yeah. You know,
you told me some interesting, like the policies and stuff like that, that revolved around Pruitt Igoe. Would you want to go into those at all? Or do you feel like that gives away too much?
No, nah, you should probably just see the movie.
Okay.
Not everything is economic related. Some things that happened in Pruitt Igoe that were bad for the communities that live there were policy related.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they were racially, you know,
motivated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because from what I understood, it was supposed to be like this, like, you know, this new 21st century city kind of thing where it's like, oh, like we're going to have a great solution for people who are disenfranchised or poor or something like that. And it's going to be this
great intentions.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole thing was
this turnkey solution.
Yeah. It was supposed to be the future of cities. It was going to be looked at as like the house on the hill, you know, like this is the beacon of what cities should do to help people that are in slums. And it started out fantastic. They were like really well built apartments they were decked out with.
Yeah. They were pre-furnished too.
Pre-furnished. Really nice. Yeah. They were really nice. But then over time, St. Louis, the context, a lot of what the movie's talking about is the context of St. Louis was burning to the ground financially, basically, at this time.
Mm-hmm.
They call it the white flight, basically, where this was the time that people started leaving cities and going into suburbs, and the financial planners of the city didn't see it coming, and they basically ran out of money to help pay for Pruitt Igoe. And so now they had to have people that live there pay for it, and it just became nothing could get repaired anymore. It became a cycle of politicians didn't want to put money towards Pruitt Igoe because, hey, we can't raise taxes, we can't do this, and it just spiraled out of control. Then it became what we know as today is a disaster with crime, and it ultimately led to its destruction.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So I'll check it out. It's Pruitt Igoe Myth. It's a good history on race relations in St. Louis, and a big... If anyone takes architecture classes, for sure, I'm sure they've done research on Pruitt Igoe. They've had to read about it because it's kind of the example of a failure in public housing.
Mm-hmm. Just go see it?
No, yeah, let's just go. Yeah, go see it. Move on to what you want to.
Mine's going to be short and sweet. As far as documentary, I mean, Kyle and Neil seem to have a much higher palette than what I do with it because I haven't really, you know, dived too deep with documentaries. But so I'm going to talk about the first documentary that I ever saw that kind of got me ever awakened to the fact that documentaries are important. That was King Korn. It's back from 2007. It was made by a guy named David Wolf. And essentially it just goes into the fact that these two guys make an acre of corn and they go, what is the corn industry? What has it done? Where did it come from? And what is it going to do in the future? And it's pretty interesting because it gets into the fact of subsidies. It gets into the facts of like lobbying within Congress as far as just pushing corn and that no one's really making money off of it. Like you actually are making like a huge deficit out of it and how all the farmers that if you are trapped, well, if you are farming corn, like you're essentially trapped in the corn industry. And the only way to like get out of the corn industry is by buying more land for more corn. And so it just like it goes into that kind of spiral, and then it'll go into stuff like high fructose corn syrup and just all the essentially the what's the word I'm
like
looking
health
for?
Health concerns. And
yeah, the health concerns, but just the, you know, where the ripple goes out to. Like, you know, I was trying to, there's a particular word that describes that, but I'm trying to remember it. But yeah, just the ripple effect of, you know, what has corn done to our country? Because corn is something that has put industry as far as a top capability, because I mean from lubricants to fuels, corn is there. From food, corn is there. From supplying X, Y, and Z in every single industry, we have figured out to make corn useful. But I don't know. I would still recommend it. King Korn. It's not too long. I think it's like 95 minutes long. Pretty digestible. And I'd recommend anyone to check it out. Yeah.
That was good.
Woo! Woo, that I had to contain my boom laugh for that one. But seeing as very obviously we are talking about documentary, our entire episode is going to be focusing on documentary and specifically Hillary's America. And I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Kyle over here. Yeah, so Kyle, take it away as far as, you know, what Hillary's America was about, what we got and gleaned from it.
Well, yeah, for all of our listeners out there, if you can't guess, we all kind of lean towards the liberal side of the political spectrum, to say the least. But that's not what we're going to really try to break down in terms of Hillary's America in this film. Because, yeah, maybe there are things we don't agree with the film, with the documentary, but really we're interested in the, I guess you would say, the tactics.
The techniques.
Like, is, you know, maybe how you classify it in the documentary spectrum. What is a documentary?
Right.
Does this classify? Is D'Souza, is the filmmaker a documentarian?
Right. I mean, it's kind of a philosophical question.
Yeah, it really, yeah. And it kind of, with documentary, more than any other genre, more than any other type of film, you really start discussing what is truth.
Right. Well, at the end of it, that's kind of what documentaries are. You know, mm-hmm. you go into a documentary expecting truth. That's just part of what documentaries are.
Yeah, it's about seeing the reality of it all.
Right.
Yeah, you think you're not going into a fiction film.
Exactly.
You think you're going into a film that is genuinely trying to share something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a mistake. You should not go into really any film. Maybe Finding Dory. You can go into that thinking these people are going to try to share some lessons, some good-hearted things. But any film, you should really retain your skepticism, which, to take it back, is what I respect so much about Errol Morris.
Right, yeah.
We should all be skeptics all the time. And so it's really important, especially with a film like this, to retain your skepticism because yeah. it's got an agenda just as much as, if not more so, than something like King Korn does.
Right, or a narrative film.
Yeah.
Or anything, you know, like has much more of an agenda than usually a narrative film does.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's the whole film is put under this kind of premise of an exploration or an investigation.
What if the goal of the Democratic Party is to steal the most valuable thing the world has ever produced? What if their plan is to steal America? Who will stop them now?
He sets up the premise for the film as an exploration. Who are Democrats?
Right.
Who are these Democrats?
Who are these Democrats? What is the history of this political party? And he wants you to think, the filmmaker definitely wants you to think that you're joining him on this journey. When really, in my opinion, the whole film is a scripted lecture.
Right.
It is.
Yeah. It's not an exploration of fact. It's an exploration of, I want to tell my own ideologies.
Well, it kind of, we were talking about earlier, there's a conclusion before we've began.
Yes.
Before the movie starts, or before any of his interviews or any of his reenactments, there's a conclusion that he's trying to frame. There is no participatory. There's no him learning new information or getting something that he didn't know from an interviewer or interviewee.
Yeah.
It's all staged almost in a way.
So the film is almost entirely scripted. It almost works more as a narrative film than it does, like a fictitious narrative film than it does a documentary.
Not even the reenactments of like history scenes, but even just his presence, anything that he's in, because he's like the main character of the film, D'Souza, the director. He's mm-hmm. actually in the film.
Yeah.
Anything he's in is even scripted.
Yeah, and so they recreate his trial.
Yeah, I thought that was so creepy.
He has a scripted trial with actors playing the attorney, playing the judge.
And the prosecution. And
he puts filters over what they filmed and little bars to make it look like it's an actual courtroom proceeding.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
It's incredibly deceptive. One of the questions I wrote down in my notes, and I would pose this to y'all, what level of skepticism do you think the average audience member has? As in, do you think that people watching this film are meant to realize that this is a reenactment? Or do you think he's genuinely attempting to deceive us into thinking that this is footage of his courtroom trial?
Okay. I think a little bit of both.
Yeah, so I would say the courtroom, not so much, but like later on when I was getting quotes from like Hillary Clinton from like 2009 talking about the person who started the abortion clinics. Who was that again?
Well, it's Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood.
Let's not say abortion clinics.
Whatever. So Planned Parenthood, the person who started that up, that she quotes that person and they make it look like, you know, twice deleted archival footage that it tried to be hidden that wasn't in like, you know, a 16:9 thing and it was smaller and much more like a degraded as far as quality. Like, look, Hillary was trying to hide this and we found it.
Yeah.
And I went into a basement and found it because it was like, it was so much ego that this guy had to falsely uncover these things. And it was just like, this is publicly available information.
Well, yeah. So there's clearly instances of him using deceiving tactics of, is this real or is this a scripted thing? The court thing is probably the best example of it, where they made it look like it was found, not found footage, but court footage. Not even that. I think I remember it actually being, yeah, it had like a news story like ticker on the bottom.
Yeah.
But what was more important was that it was partially cut off, as if someone was recording that with their own camera or something, because the ticker wasn't complete. Mm-hmm. It was cut off, like you could only see the very top of it, and you know, maybe in the right corner it wasn't there anymore because, you know, the camera was slightly tilt, like canted or something. So it looked like someone had recorded their TV or computer screen and put it up there or something. But clearly that's not the case. But back to what you were asking, was, is he purposefully doing that to deceive people, or is it just like people are, they know it's not real?
Yeah. Does he as a filmmaker assume that they're not going to think it's real?
I think it's a little bit of both. I would say that if you asked him, he'd be like, well, of course it's not real. This is just my vision for it. But I bet you, and this is just my personal opinion, I bet you he's not upset if someone says that they thought it was real.
Oh, exactly.
You know, I think it's part of, if he catches someone, perfect, because then it seems more real. Like,
then his story helps get his point across.
Exactly, helps get his point across. But he would obviously argue that, of course this isn't real. Like, look how ridiculous this is. Like,
yeah, but at the same time, he doesn't go out of his way to like, hey, just to let you know, like, this isn't blah blah. There's
no ticket. There's nothing that says
yeah, reenacted, yeah, or these are actors, or
has been
like
altered or anything like that. But
there's another really good example of it, and it was one of the people who have honestly accused. Well, I say honestly accused. They have accused, and they believe honestly that Bill Clinton sexually assaulted them.
Right.
And so they're on video telling their story. D'Souza plays us that video, but he digitally manipulates it to make it look like it was shot on VHS, or that it was stored somewhere and the condition was deteriorating,
and
that
it was put away.
Yeah, that it was somehow put away and they unearthed it.
Mm-hmm.
When really the video is flawless. You go watch it on your own and they even show it in the background in one of the shots. None of those digital manipulations exist on the footage.
It's what you see in political ads today.
Yeah, I was about to
there's
say.
A lot of filters and there's a lot of grit to it that's to put you in a
Neil
negative
Anderson
space
want you to
of
vote.
Whoever you're seeing, you know, or whoever they're talking about. It puts it in a negative, it's subconsciously negative, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, it's maybe a little bit more deceiving because it makes it seem like it's unearthed, hidden. They happened to find, they had an inside source that took this from the DNC. Because this is literally saying that there's borderline a conspiracy in a political party to hide the history of the party. I would say hide the history of America.
Mm-hmm.
But and this is framing it as hiding the history of the party.
Yeah, and look at the subtitle of the film. It's Hillary's America, colon, the secret history
of
the
Democratic Party. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would argue that most of the movie is of the latter part of that title. I would say 2/3 of the movie is about the Democratic Party, and it's the final third that's about Hillary.
Yeah. If the final third.
If the final third. Yeah. Maybe a quarter of the film.
Indeed.
Most of it is talking about history and how it relates to the Democratic Party. So in my history, what I'm saying is like Andrew Jackson and ordering Native Americans to walk and killing Native Americans, and Andrew Jackson whipping his slaves and raping his slaves, and all in the context of saying that, hey, guys, look, this is a Democratic president that all Democrats celebrate as one of the greatest Democrats in our history. That it's all framed with a...
Well, because he doesn't even say celebrate. He takes a celebrated president, Abraham Lincoln, and then says, no, you know who the real president is that's actually a Democrat? Because Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, was this guy. And so he takes that, the fact that Abraham Lincoln celebrated, and then just replaces Andrew Jackson there and is just like, that's the real thing. And so it puts this like fake connotation of celebrity, like as if like, you know, Democrats at any point are like really proud of Andrew Jackson. And I was like, no, the reason why they looked at Abraham Lincoln is because he was a progressive thinker, and instead of like, you know,
liberal values as far as civil rights,
exactly,
human rights, and maybe I should say.
And instead of addressing that, which a documentary would, a proper documentary would, they just pull at the emotional thing. It was all about emotion and just feeling something and then just moving on and not examining anything else.
It had an extreme lack of context.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there just needed to be a guy in the background just being like, yeah, you're fucking right. States' rights. You know? And like, that was like the whole context of the film as far as just like lack of intellectual like awareness of itself towards self-awareness. Because it just like just kept saying things but just didn't ever try to look at it objectively.
Well, the reason we see Lincoln in the beginning is he walks into DNC. It's some museum or some
I think it's their headquarters in DC.
The Democratic headquarters. Yeah. And there's a museum in it. He walks in. He goes to the front desk, and there's a nice young liberal girl that's there, being like, "Oh, nice to meet you." Blah, blah. She's very, you know, happy. And also she said, and clueless, because she says she's a Democrat, and he's like, oh, why are you a Democrat? And she basically says, oh, because it's the party of civil rights and
intolerance.
Intolerance. And, you know, it cuts back to him, and he's like, really? Kind of thing, you know? And it's, to the viewer, it's a knock on this girl saying, look, she's fooled. She thinks that she's supporting a group that is tolerant and says all these things, but let's go investigate that they really aren't. And he walks in, and then there's a portrait of Abraham Lincoln right in the front. And he's like, why is Abraham Lincoln here? He is one of the first Republicans. Why would he be in the Democrat Hall Museum or whatever?
Why would they possibly revere this great president?
Right. And so he replaces the painting with a portrait of Andrew Jackson that he finds tucked away in their basement in a room that says authorized personnel only.
Oh yeah, he did it twice.
Which obviously this is clearly, it's not fake. Meant to be, it really obviously isn't meant to be taken real.
Yeah, I don't think scenes like that, I really hope that, and I don't think that there's anybody in the audience who felt that he was actually in the DNC headquarters.
Right. No, I don't
think there's actually this room. It's this visual like set piece that just kind of allows him to jump into history.
It's like he's in his head kind of thing. Like it's a fake.
Yeah, exactly. It's a this visual representation.
There you go, yeah.
And so he grabs these historical documents from downstairs in the secret Democrat lair.
That were locked away.
Yeah, where they hide all their secrets.
I loved how many minutes were just dedicated to montages of him just looking at pictures and putting it on a table and looking at pictures and putting it on a table.
Yeah.
As if like people were like, or this man is well researched.
Or, or like a neck collar, like a collar for slaves, you know? Yeah. And then like, I wonder who this slave was. And then it, you know, cuts back to Andrew Jackson ordering 300 lashes of this woman, you know, really showing Democratic values right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then just once again, knee jerk and more emotional more emotion, energy put into it. But
here's the real dangerous part about the film.
Yeah.
The really dangerous part is that these facts, there are a lot of true facts in this film. Like, yes, Andrew Jackson did do this. He was an aggressor.
He was a terrible person.
He was a bad person. He might have represented what America was back then. Everyone felt that way. You know, like it wasn't just a Democrat thing. I'm getting off the point though. The real point is that the context of which he's saying things is presenting this argument that it's not about the people that are in it. about the people, what they stood for, who they represented. It's about the party.
It's about labels.
It's about labels. Exactly.
And if you can label this person as a Democrat back then, well, surely then does that mean he's... It's difficult to say because I don't know if he's actually saying that modern Democrats share these values. But I think he's trying to say all these people are dishonest by not acknowledging their history of racial oppression or slavery.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he uses these, I like to call them half-truths.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, he presents facts. But when you do, when you intentionally take away the context,
right,
you can paint it in whatever light you like. Yeah. And those are the most deceiving lies are the ones that have the grain of truth.
Right. And that's what, yeah, that is what's dangerous of the film, is that there are truths that you could go back and, yes, this actually happened. But when you jump to a conclusion that is not supported by these actual facts, but people will follow those conclusions, that's why it's dangerous. Because mm-hmm. when you're arguing, or not arguing, but if you're discussing this with someone
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to disagree with whatever he's saying, he's like, someone will just retort, well, it happened. Like, you can't say that this didn't happen. Like, well, I know this actually happened, but that doesn't mean that this conclusion is correct.
It sounds a little bit like, and I haven't seen the film you recommended yet, Pruitt-Igoe, but it sounds a little bit like what that film is trying to combat. And so my understanding, for years, they're using this Pruitt-Igoe housing development as an example of why progressive housing is not going to work ever. It's not going to be a success.
Mm-hmm.
And you can pick to the points that you like for its failure and only illustrate that aspect of the story.
Right.
Instead of, I just wish everyone could be more honest and actually try to understand something. And it takes so much more effort to understand the context of a historical event to what this documentary you brought up is trying to do, Pruitt-Igoe, trying to show you maybe a side of the context that you haven't seen.
That's exactly what, yeah, it's trying to give context of the city that when reading maybe something in a history book mm-hmm. isn't giving you the decades of history of the city, mm-hmm. you know.
And Hillary's America, the entire film is an effort in hiding context.
Yes,
I thought it was a holistic approach of critical analysis. You're a fool, Kyle.
Damn liberals.
Hey, because we can talk all day about maybe inaccuracies of the film, or like maybe something that, you know, like
we could talk about all the things we disagree with,
right? But at the end of the day, it comes back to how things are being framed and how that immediately changes the argument of like who has the burden of evidence now? Who has the burden of disproving someone?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, that's very difficult to, when you're already framed in a negative light or you're already framed on the defensive, it's hard to fight that.
Yeah, it's a cheap, dishonest tactic, no matter who takes it. The filmmaker has, his first film was about Michael Moore.
Right.
Who also uses similar tactics.
He does.
None of us here are the biggest fans of his films. I think we've all seen a couple.
Yeah. Never trust a film. I'm actually not a fan of Michael Moore.
No, neither am I. I think Michael Moore is his level of false sarcasm and just like of course the Bush administration just had no idea what was going on. You know, it just has this very already presumpted idea toward it. Like how you were saying, Tori, like there is a conclusion that we're just working toward that the filmmakers made and is not going to allow you to be educated, but is going to allow you to think how they think, which is a very dangerous and backwards way of doing something.
And it's so ironic that this filmmaker who criticized Michael Moore,
right,
is, they're both doing the same things for different sides of the political spectrum.
Well, we now know that he's criticizing Michael Moore not because of his film tactics, but because he's a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's criticizing him. He's showing him why he's wrong in these subjects, like whatever Michael Moore is talking about in his movies, and showing the deceiving tactics he's using. But he himself is doing the exact same thing to the nth degree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not even close.
Indeed.
And I don't like Michael Moore for the same reasons that we're talking about right now. But goddamn, at least Michael Moore hadn't literally shown someone to be Satan in their film. Like, yeah. I don't know how to, like, there literally in Hillary's America, there is no qualms about showing characters or any liberal or opposition as being either an idiot, straight up evil, manipulative,
or manipulated.
Or too manipulated dumb
to
yeah.
understand that they're being misled.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just really insulting, I think. It should be insulting to all Americans.
It should be.
You know, people who decry the state of politics now, how divided we are, this is fueling the fire. Things like this, in my opinion, fuel the fire.
Yeah.
They're not actually trying to understand Democrats, or in Michael Moore's case, Republicans as people. They're not trying to get the heart of why does somebody believe this? How can I relate to them? How can we meet somewhere in the middle?
Not at all.
It's demonization.
Yeah, it's not about opening discussion.
No.
It's about confirming your bias.
And closing the discussion.
Yeah. And closing the discussion. It's it is the slam dunk.
Yeah.
It is the drop the mic. There's nothing left to talk about. You can't
I'm right, you're wrong.
Right. You can't how can you beat what I just said? Mm-hmm. You can't because I'm right.
Yeah, I'll try to listen.
I just proved how I'm right. I don't need to re-say this because now I'm just repeating myself. You know, it's
the film.
It's sad.
Spoiler alert: the film after the credits has a little moment,
and it's very revealing.
This isn't too much of a spoiler.
It's very revealing.
It's very revealing.
I mean, it is revealing in the sense of we know what the movie's about. It's it's not hiding it, but after the credits, it explicitly tells what the movie's about.
Yeah, and so he's teaching this English as a second language class, I guess, for people who want to become citizens. And he says, you know how you've actually become an American? You become a Republican.
The class answers. They answer with that. Yeah, that's even more important.
Yeah.
That he's taught them this.
Yes, the immigrants are saying, you are a Republican. That's how you know you're an American.
Yeah. I love the immigrants that are being taught by the Republican who's in jail for... political money?
His campaign finance.
Yeah, campaign finance.
He had a felony. He basically had straw donors that he got his buddies to donate for him so he didn't go over the limit.
Yeah, and I like how even he modeled that after the Obama administration was just going after him for that and making him almost sound like an innocent character for that. Like, I was just trying to support my party.
Well, yeah, like a big part of the opening and, you know, a big reason for this movie, too, even though it's about the Democrats, it's about Hillary, it's also to reframe his narrative in a way.
To fix his brand.
It's to help his image, for sure.
And not only that, but it helps the film, too.
It does.
Because it makes him sound a bit like a martyr.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It makes it sound like he's on to the truth so that they're actually trying to silence him.
Yeah. Right.
Which, I don't want to draw too big a comparison here. But a thing with documentaries now that you see a lot of days, there's a term thrown around, social justice warriors.
Yeah.
And there's another one that's like, what is it? It's like
armchair protesters?
Yeah, couch something protesters, like that.
Armchair quarterback?
Basically, you've got these films that are just meant to outrage you and show you corruption or show you how terrible the sugar industry is.
Mm-hmm.
And get you outraged and feel like you're being oppressed.
Yeah, when someone's going up against authority, even if that authority, they're not really going up against anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're fabricating this authority. When someone's going up against authority, you feel like they're a hero.
You want to vindicate this person.
Oh, yeah.
You want to help them, and you want to, like, if they're trying to silence this guy, what is it he's trying to say? Never mind the fact that he pled guilty.
Yeah, he did plead guilty.
And it was very clear. There was no question that the crimes were committed.
Well, yeah, okay, so yeah, even in the scene for the trial, this is the very beginning of the film, you know, his defense attorney, you know, has a nice quick little patriotic speech about rights. And, you know, he's like, hey, I was just trying to help a friend out kind of thing. And the prosecution are conniving young, almost like yuppies that are just trying to progress their careers, you know, and they even kind of have that like face or whatever. They just like, oh, gross. You know, like you wouldn't want to be casted as these people because they're villains.
Yeah.
He has no problem of posing the other side as clear villains.
Yeah. And how disrespectful.
That's opposite of Errol Morris right there.
Yeah.
The exact opposite.
Polar opposites. It's so disrespectful. And I would really love to sit down with him and talk to him about what he intends us to take away from a scene like that. Is it supposed to be funny that these people are like caricatures of liberals?
they're not even caricatures of liberals. They're just caricatures of bad people.
Yeah.
And we know that they're Democrats because
they're oppressing this
they're
guy.
Bad people.
Yeah.
You know, like there aren't I don't know. It's
in my mind incredibly un-American.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Look,
but at the very end,
casting
they let you know that it's
half
most
of the country
thing.
As villains. Again, either they're too stupid or they're evil or they're just misled. That's half the country.
Mm-hmm. And to make it a little more fair, there are certainly liberals who paint half the country as unapologetic racists.
Yes, they do.
Which this film is trying to respond to just in an incredibly uneven, dishonest way.
Right.
So it's definitely played by both sides. I don't want anyone to think that we're just a bunch of liberals bashing on this guy. Michael Moore uses the same tactics. And as filmmakers, we just shouldn't accept it.
No, it's like hearing rhetoric in politics nowadays. It's hard to walk back from that plank at that point, you know, right. And people can't talk about it anymore without getting in a feud.
And nobody should accept that as the status quo, I think. Doesn't matter what side of the political aisle you're on. And if you keep that sense of skepticism, it'll help you identify pieces of propaganda like this.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, I think we all agree that's basically what this comes down to. This is electioneering propaganda.
Yes. It is.
Good old America. Yeah, even more so getting rewinding the film a little bit backward from the end credits of the whole, like, you know, you're American when you're Republican, the sheer distaste and the absolute disgust and use of symbols and signifiers that are all things America, from a little girl singing, you know, America the Beautiful and, you know, God Bless America.
They finished with two songs.
Yeah.
Back to back.
Yeah, with a chorus.
It's three.
I'm pretty sure it's three. I'm pretty sure it's the Star Spangled Banner.
That was the last one.
America the Beautiful.
And they did God Bless America.
God Bless America. It was three back to back musical numbers.
Using all that and like how many American flags possibly that you could overlay or composite into some kind of shot with the most traditional stock imagery of like picking up my son after wrapping a barbed wire fence and looking at our barn we built together and then looking up in the sky and seeing the blue angel streak across the sky as I drink my Budweiser. was just the most like American
or family thing. Embracing after a veteran comes back from a tour in Iraq or something. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It was nothing, once again, and that shows contextually like that film was all about filling you with emotion and not intellect, and taking advantage of your emotions and just building you up more and more and be like, you see all this that you love? Those Democrats are trying to ruin this and take it away.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say that. So vote for the crazy guy with a wig.
This November.
Yeah. Which was interesting, though, that they never talked about Trump.
Well, at the time the film was made, he probably wasn't the nominee yet.
Not true,
because the edits and stuff like that even included things like
The Orlando shooting.
They added that in post, but the lion's share of the film couldn't advocate for one candidate over the other.
I see what you're saying.
Because they were still in the primaries.
That'd take too much time.
It's easier for them to add a little news footage to scare you in the beginning.
Yeah.
But maybe they could have added a little bit of Trump at the end, but in all honesty, that kind of defeats the whole narrative.
Yeah, it's about the Democrats. Mm. It's about Hillary.
Yeah, not to mention Trump kind of... I mean, they spend a lot of the film talking about the KKK.
Yeah.
And I brought this up after we left the film. They don't acknowledge or they don't recognize the fact that it was the Republican candidate this year who was endorsed by the leader of the KKK.
Right. And what was the thing about the money? I don't really want to get into politics too much, but part of the film was talking about Andrew Jackson and how the Democrats support Andrew Jackson. And then just, you know, recently, pretty relevant when they were considering taking Andrew Jackson off our currency and putting Harriet Tubman. Who's the side that disagreed with that?
Yeah, they...
Yeah. The Democrats, because they hate black people.
Of course.
Am I the only one who's not taking crazy pills around here? But, safe to say, it's it, what we saw was something that, you know, it shows the danger of misrepresenting media and misrepresenting ideas. But as far as documentary, I mean, always make sure that you're looking at something and ask yourself, you know, if you're going to diagnose, because a lot of people don't know how to diagnose a documentary. I said, you know, for a good bit, I didn't know. And just be like, you know, are we looking at things objectively? Is this just a completely subjective thing? What kind of questions are being asked? Are conclusions being drawn as we explore the content, or are conclusions already set in stone and we're just reaching to that? But I know we're going to add in some other documentaries as well in the information down below as far as other documentaries that we would recommend that definitely pass through the Cinephile filter as far as not being a bunch of bullshit. And also things that are exploring other types of documentaries. I know that there's like six different types that we talked about, but I'll break that out down below. But anybody else with some quick closing comments for today's episode?
Yeah. So to bring it back to our man, Errol Morris, the title of his photo essay book, which is a series of essays where he follows his curiosity and breaks down the powers and the deceptive powers of photography, is called Believing is Seeing. Usually we hear seeing is believing. And Errol Morris, with these photo essays, really wants us to remind us that seeing is not believing. You may be seeing these reenactments, but in this case, they're only confirming what you already believed.
Mm-hmm.
In one of his essays, he shows how one of the photos from Abu Ghraib only confirmed what people already believed. And then guess what? Three major news outlets got it all wrong. They didn't actually analyze the photo. They took it at face value. And so, remember, believing is not seeing, according to, or seeing is not believing, according to Errol Morris. And it's just always important to retain your skepticism.
Yep.
It's so important with documentary, because every documentary wants to present itself as unadulterated fact. This is history, or this is truth. Well, maybe not every documentary, but a lot of these exposés and political ones.
And then I know we need to get out of here, but just one quick thing. This episode turned out to be very much kind of on the negative side of documentary, or the dangerous side. Documentaries are such a good thing. They're important for film. They get stories out that maybe you otherwise wouldn't have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Someday we'll do another episode. Maybe we'll talk about some good documentaries. Hillary's America was just too juicy of a topic not to talk about, and it's really fresh in our minds. So,
well, sometimes you learn so much from watching the bad movies.
You do.
You learn.
I've learned a lot. I was very informed about documentaries.
So contrast is sometimes the most important thing in life.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to episode 10 of Cinephile. Big accomplishment. High fives for everybody. Episode 10. Woo! Yeah. So episode 10, important stuff. Thank you for keeping up with us. And a special shout out for anyone who's kept with us all the way from episode 1. We appreciate it.
Oh boy.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much. I've been Cooper Carr.
Kyle Montgomery.
And Neil Anderson.
Thanks again. Have a good one.
See you.